Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 11th, 2005. This session is entitled, A Bird is a Bird, A Bush is a Bush, Right? Why Emily Dickinson or Moses Would Disagree. Presented in the Creekside Room by Keitha Schwen. Disc number SCK-2005-01. Let's listen in.
Progress and things like that. Each class will focus on one or two specific poems, and we'll do sort of close readings of them and really try to sort of get at the meat of what is going on in the poem itself. But then we'll also kind of at the end open up into a broader conversation that tries to sort of get at and connect with other sessions that are happening during the week, bringing in those points of view and things like that. And also looking at comparing this to the theme for the summer, which is take off your shoes in the story of Moses and the burning bush. So we'll try to make those connections. And this week also, the poems themselves that we'll be looking at are kind of focused on seeing well and how we see things. And in most poems, there's two types of seeing that's going on. There's our close reading of the poem as readers of it, and there's also we're encountering a speaker's view of the world, which is very specific. And a lot of times, even when it seems that it's unbiased, it is biased in certain ways. And so what we'll really try to do is get into the poems and see not just what's the speaker seeing, but what is the way in which they see, what does that tell us about the speaker themselves? And I hope that helps us as we go out into the world and practice seeing ourselves. The other thing that I'm sort of trying to promote during these weeks that I'm here is John was talking today a lot about time and about our lack of time and about being busy, and Rabbi added that that a lot of people don't have the patience for symphonies anymore, for music, to really sit still and listen. And I think the same is true in poetry. And so specifically what started happening is that there's a kind of poetry that is often labeled as being accessible that people, even myself, like to read sometimes, which is a sort of poem where you get to the end of it and kind of go, oh, because you immediately understand what the poem's about. You get what's going on, and maybe there's kind of a punchline at the end that sort of explains it all to you. There's nothing wrong with that poetry, but I'm gonna argue while we're talking that good poetry, really good poetry, isn't explained, and you can't figure it out in a single reading. That a good poem, that the instinct should be immediately to go back and reread the poem itself. Also want to stress for people that haven't been to Holden before and people that have been to Holden a million times that this is a very Holden-esque discussion of poetry, which means that all views are welcome, that we want to hear from everyone, that we believe that everyone's voice isn't just encouraged, but it's sort of necessary to have this conversation about this thing, and that you're encouraged to disagree with me. And there's some things that I want to bring to light about the poem, but I've chosen the poems that I've chosen because I don't understand them completely. There's things that I like about them, but I don't get them. I return to them over and over again to try to figure it out, but I can't. So that's why I'm really excited to talk about it with all of you. I also don't get to talk about poems within a community of people, many people at least, who have faith as a central part of their lives. A lot of what I encounter in the academic world is people that don't want to bring in conversations about God and things into the discussion. And with somebody like Emily Dickinson, I think our discussion of such things is broadened if we can come at it from those angles too. So, are there any questions? I just said a lot. Yes, Rick?
I have a question, but I know one thing that you mentioned is that people, in fact, don't know about faith topics or
absolutely
to even bring in if they want to. It's that you've been kind of shocked to realize how little people actually know the Bible.
Yeah, and I know very little myself, so I encourage people to go ahead.
You said about the Bible. It's one of the great piece of literature. I mean, it's just, you can't, how do you know Western culture without having some working knowledge of the Bible,
yeah,
even if you aren't Christian?
Absolutely. Okay.
When you said the speaker, what the speaker is seeing, in this case, you mean the boy?
I don't, that's a great question. In poems, we, a lot of times, and sometimes these words get confused, you have the poet, who's the person who's physically writing the poem. But a lot of times, the voice in the poem who is saying I or we, the one who's talking, is not the same as the poet. Sometimes it can be fairly close to the nature of the poet, but even if the person, even if this, the speaker of the poem says, I'm Emily Dickinson, and I think da 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 da, we still look at, we still say that it's a speaker in the poem who's separate from the poet, because if we don't make that separation, a lot of icky things can start happening where we start assuming things about the poet that is not necessarily true. Does that kind of make sense? So we'll stick to talking about the speaker of the poem. But I know very little about Emily Dickinson, and so if other people have anecdotes or stories or insights and want to add that to the mix of the conversation, that's great. Just specify that you're talking about Emily Dickinson, the poet, and not the speaker of the poem, who could be disparate kind of individuals. Does that sort of make sense? Any other questions before we start? Okay, I also sometimes have a tendency to speak quickly or to throw around phrases or words that if you don't know what I'm talking about, stop me, because probably nobody else does either, and maybe even I don't know. So, okay. I'm going to do something very unholy in this session, which is that Gail shrieks. We're going to look at two of the poems that you have, and both are similar in that they're about birds or their central sort of character. We're going to go through both of them very carefully, and then at the end, the question that I'm going to ask you is, which poem is better? Which is very, very unholden, because we like to... And both poems I love and have cared about for a long time, but I'm going to ask that question, and you can say which one you like better, or you can argue which one is just a better poem, and so that's kind of where I'm interested in going with this.
Will you tell us which one you think is better?
Maybe at the very end. I may just give it away in my discussion of it, but... But so when we talk about what's going to be a better poem, we're all dealing with different ideas of what makes a good poem, obviously. And so we can bring those into the final discussion. One definition that I want to give you is one of my teachers, who's a wonderful woman named Patricia Godica, a poet who lives in Montana, says that a good poem always begins in the body and ends in the body and makes an arc through the mind. Begins in the body and ends in the body and makes an arc through the mind. Paul Olson, who did the session before me, also talked about the importance of poems as being a felt experience, that it's not just an intellectual, pretty way to talk about a philosophy, that we feel what's happening in the poem. And that idea of it beginning in the body, beginning as an actual experience that we have, and ending in the body, but moving through our heads as well, that a good poem should be able to do that. So I'm just going to leave that. But as we come up with other ideas, or actually, does anyone have a few that they want to just toss out now to you, when you get, what says this was a good poem to you when you get to the end?
There's a Mary Oliver poem I read, in which when I finished it, I wept.
Okay, first so reading. An emotional response.
First reading.
Okay.
Couldn't breathe. Undone.
Okay.
Something in me, clearly, but.
Okay. Are there other ways to know?
I guess I feel a good poem is like where I can feel like I'm right there with the poet. Doesn't feel what he's feeling, I think.
Okay, so a sense of holding your attention to the present moment.
Yes, of concrete images.
Concrete. Okay, so like specific details that you can see.
This is very basic, but anything with that on music or something, I always say, I wish.
I wish I'd done that. That's awesome. Yeah. That's wonderful. Peter.
What you were saying earlier, that you immediately want to go back to, that it isn't some sort of passing interest, that even if you don't understand it or don't necessarily have an extremely strong emotional response to it, you immediately think, you immediately
And to remember, too, that as we're starting with Dickinson, and I'm going to go into some more contemporary poets later in the week, too, who are even maybe a little more out there, that even a line that you want to go back to, even a single image, even some weird, like, syntax, somehow the order of the words seems odd, and you're like, what is going on there? And maybe it just irks you. Maybe it makes you mad. It doesn't always have to be a positive reason to go back. Anything else?
I think it's that usually a phrase hooks me, mm-hmm. and I can tell I'm going to carry it around for the day. It's going to follow me.
Absolutely.
In the room below, the women talk of Michelangelo,
yeah.
And it's just I just keep coming back to the rhythm and
yes.
the image. And,
yes.
And,
so sometimes it's the music itself,
the music
poetry itself. That gets into our bodies and doesn't release us. Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, for me, Emily Dickinson has an ability for me. Hit those notes.
Yes.
Talk about the music.
Yes.
Those notes for me. And I do. And it almost might come across just a couple lines and she can order those words. So she can hit. That's that button.
Yep. Wonderful. And we'll talk, I hope you can say more, we'll later on talk specifically about the music in these poems and well, let's get to the poems then. So I would like to start with 335. Would someone read it for us?
Kate, okay, what does the 1945 and the 1891?
Yeah. You know, I was looking through my book. That's a good question. I believe that the 1862 is as best as they know when it was written, and the 1945 and the 1891 is when it was first published or put into publication. She had very few poems at all that came out during her lifetime, so. But, okay. Well, I'm gonna read it through once, but then somebody else is gonna have to volunteer because we're gonna hear it again, so be thinking about if you're gonna do that. Okay. 'Tis not that dying hurts us so, 'tis living hurts us more. But dying is a different way, a kind behind the door. The southern custom of the bird, that ere the frosts are due, accepts a better latitude. We are the birds that stay. The shiverers round farmers' doors, for whose reluctant crumb we stipulate till pitying snows persuade our feathers home. Elsa?
'Tis not that dying hurts us so, 'tis living hurts us more. But dying is a different way, a kind behind the door. The southern custom of the bird, that ere the frosts are due, accepts better latitude. We are the birds that stay. The shiverers round farmers' doors, for whose reluctant crumb we stipulate, till pitying snows persuade our feathers home.
Any just initial reactions when I throw out a line that you like, a line that unsettles you? You don't have to say anything profound about it, just kind of, yeah.
Two quick things. The notion that living hurts us more,
mm-hmm.
makes it powerful. You know, I read that.
Yeah.
Except
yeah.
then the use of snow, sort of quiet snow covering us over,
mm-hmm.
and it's the way to gently go off to die.
Mm-hmm.
The thing I wondered about, probably the birds. Sometimes the birds as harbingers of death, like crows.
I tend to think of birds as signs of new life, like starting in the spring, hearing the birds chirping, or in the morning when things are starting to rustle and you start hearing
mm-hmm.
the birds. So, but I also see your image.
So different sort of ideas of birds that she's either using or maybe playing off against. So we have two types of birds that she's talking about in the poem. What are the two types?
Those who go south before the winter comes and those who stay.
Okay, and which ones are we?
Birds that
stay. Doesn't sound like that much fun. Or the Minnesotans, I guess. And she begins, like Robin's saying, she opens with this really big line, 'tis not that dying hurts us so, 'tis living hurts us more. Immediately we have us. It's a poem that's going to be about her, but also about us. We're all included in that. Or are we? Who is the us that she's talking about?
Human experience.
So you think all humans? Okay. So that this is, so Gail, what you're saying is that it's a human experience that we don't have a choice, that for everyone that life is a painful experience sort of until we die. That she wants to include all of us in that. Okay.
I kind of think about the dying and the living as the two different kinds of birth. Maybe the dying ones that live in the south.
Okay, that's a good question. Ken's bringing up, which we seem to have two different types of birds, and we also seem to have living and dying here. So, which brings us to at the end of that first, maybe I should turn this on so we can look at it. Can everybody see a little bit? More or less? Okay. So, the end here, kind behind the door, she's talking about dying. Dying is a different way, a kind behind the door, the southern custom of the bird. Is that a continued description of dying? Or when she breaks that stanza, are we talking about an entirely different
metaphor? She is. I mean, I think that her structure is the dying is the kind behind the door, and then she uses three lines to explain that in the southern birds.
Okay, so that once we, that dying is this act of when the frost, or like you were saying, when the snows come, that death is going to be something warm and tropical. Is that kind of?
Snow is pitying. Snows take pity on us in our harsh life, and is driving us to a more of a better place, which is a better death.
Death.
Death. To me, they're floating around. Oftentimes, death is cold. It's like a moon of cold earth. And she seems to be flipping this around to the mountain.
Home as more death, cold in the ground. Do you have another idea? No?
No, I'm saying the snow is, if you look at it, that the snow is persuading their feathers home to the south where it's warm.
Okay, back to the south. Okay, so a return to the south. It's a return at some level. Okay, we'll come back to that. But those are good, both are good understandings. So, the back to this notion of the us. How are, let's talk, somebody say more about the kind of life that these birds, this us, are choosing to lead.
Maybe faithful.
Faithful? Okay, what makes you say faithful?
Well, I was just thinking about how a bit here in, you know, up here, and you think about a faithful life as turning to a being difficult. Or like, you know, Moses making the contract by taking off his shoes. Basically, it's hard. He's lonely. It's not accepted by anyone. So by faithful, I'm kind of tying in the religious.
Okay.
My initial response was a little different, more like that we're kind of sticklers, we don't deal well with change, we want to stay where we are, and it's going to be more difficult, but we're going to stay there, you know? Okay. So,
So being set in our ways, as maybe that's a different understanding of faith.
I have a feeling it has to do with choosing life, as opposed to fleeing to the south.
Okay.
Fleeing away from life. That we are the people who stay where we are, face whatever we have, like the people who negotiate their crumbs every day.
Okay.
Claim our place.
Yeah.
Okay. But the place that we claim, if we're the ones that stick around and deal with that, is there, in her description here, does it seem like what we get is both joy and hardship, or is it mostly just the hardship in her understanding? You've got a stick
in the living.
What's the staying and shivering around the farmer door is the living that hurts us more.
But is that, but I'm asking, does that sound like a happy life you'd like to choose, or does that sound like?
I think both, because you wouldn't choose it if it wasn't something that was rewarding, but it obviously is hard and challenging. So you can't really say happy or sad. It's both.
So.
To me.
So the stipulating for the crumbs, it's both about it being cold and the hardship, but that the joy of life is present in that image as well.
I don't see that at all. I actually, this is the quote of somebody who's ready to suicide.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because
life is so cold and it's so bleak, and the metaphor is it's like cold for the birds to make your salvage. This is to escape.
Okay.
This is it. Escape is death. It's the easier way than.
So it's a suicide note? That it's a suicide note, or maybe it's a poem about the joys of living in all its many splendorous parts. So go ahead.
Actually, the other phrase that I'm kind of curious about is the word the kind behind the door. What is the kind?
Yes.
Kind, actually being kind. Maybe death is behind the door and death is kind. I don't know. A kind.
I think
like it's a noun.
That's a great question, because we have two doors in this poem. We have the capitalized door with the kind behind it, and then we have the door that has the farmer behind it. Does anybody want to make a connection between, are those the same doors? How are those doors?
One is the living door and one is the dying door.
Which is which?
I think the kind behind the door and what the birds do when they go south is a description of what death is. It's not either or, it's just a description of what death is.
Okay.
The death is a checking out, and it's got this life beyond a veil that we can't see. It's in the south, we can't see it. But the living is this other thing that is not, it's not a choice of one or the other. We are both of these. And the living birds, were the birds that stay, and those next three lines are describing the life of the living, because that's where we are now. We are living. Not in that behind the door thing. We are living, and our living is that shivering and hiding away from those living problems.
You know, I think of the bird that stays, though, it only comes to my mind in Minnesota, is the cardinal. And, you know, I think that I see that bird, you know, despite all the harshness and severity of the snow, how it stands out, this wonderful thing, this red thing of beauty against the white. And so that's a bird that stays. And in some way, she's, I don't see it being like suicidal. I see it as this poem as being somehow that beautiful bird, that beautiful call in the cardinal name, which I can't get into, you know, against the, you can't. What's the sound?
Yeah,
I know. But, you know, sort of that against the cold.
So you're kind of saying that even if the living is hardship and that's what's being described, that there's a certain kind of beauty that comes with that sort of endurance.
Yeah, and part of it is, right, is the poem itself. But I have one other question, and that's, I always thought stipulate meant to state something.
No.
Stipulate, yeah, what's it?
This goes back to Rabbi's Bible study, because it means to make an agreement or covenant with. So, yes, so that is another good question about this poem, what it means that these birds, what sort of covenant are they making with this farmer who's giving them crumbs? What kind of agreement is it made?
Yeah, I guess until that statement, I was thinking it kind of differently, that thinking of those who stay because they want the security of knowing there's going to be some crumbs there, because facing that long journey south, all kinds of terrible things can happen on the way, and that's out into the unknown. And here you have, at least you know that there's going to be some crumbs to pick up, and it's a hesitation to leave on that journey for the fear of the unknown, and that this offers the security of the known.
So there's security in staying where we are, even if it's rough, because who knows what's going to happen down south. So then the other sort of question back to the door thing is, if this is a metaphor about if us or the birds that stay, is the farmer a metaphor? Is the farmer symbolic of someone else, or is the farmer just a farmer? And if it's somebody else, who is it?
Sounds like my boss.
It's Robin's boss.
I'm humbling around his door, come payday. Please, I'll take my check
now.
And then it's a stipulation, right?
And it could be a symbol for God.
And
it could be God. Okay.
It's kind of like
the other boss.
Yeah.
And all the
other
all sorts of stuff.
There's more copies on the table, too. Are we okay, or do people want lights off? It's okay. Okay, so I'll read it once, and somebody else is going to have to read it the second time. So discern in your heart whether that will be you. Good, that's good. Okay, so 328. A bird came down the walk. He did not know I saw. He bit an angleworm in halves and ate the fellow, raw. And then he drank a dew from a convenient grass and then hopped sidewise to the wall to let a beetle pass. He glanced with rapid eyes that hurried all around. They looked like frightened beings, I thought. He stirred his velvet head. Like one in danger, cautious, I offered him a crumb, and he unrolled his feathers and rowed him softer home. Then oars divide the ocean, too silver for a sea, or butterflies off banks of new leap, lashless as they swim. Wants to read it for the second time.
I'll read it.
A bird came down the walk. He did not know I saw. He bit an angle worm in halves and ate the fellow raw. And then he drank a dew from a convenient grass and then hopped sidewise to the wall to let a beetle pass. He glanced with rapid eyes that hurried all around. They looked like frightened beads, I thought. He stirred his velvet head like one in danger, cautious. I offered him a crumb. He unrolled his feathers and rowed softer. Then oars divide the ocean to silver for a sea, or butterflies off banks of the blue, deep lashes as they swim.
Okay. The first question I'm going to ask is what different about the bird in this poem as compared to the bird or birds in the previous
poem?
Lighthearted. Okay, so we have a different tone maybe going on. Okay. Would everybody go ahead?
I said it seems like a real bird in this one.
Seems like a real bird. Okay, so we're not in giant metaphor land of the other poem. We're immediately dealing with a real bird and a real speaker. And do we feel like we are the bird in any way yet, or that we're just observing the bird? Observing the bird, right. So in this one, very clearly, we have a speaker who's very present, who's physically there observing the bird, and we have the bird itself. And somebody just kind of, can somebody summarize just what the bird does in the poem? What actually happens?
Eats a worm, has a drink.
Has a drink.
Jumps to the side.
Uh-huh.
Flies
up, and what happens? What does the speaker do?
Watches.
Tries to feed it.
Watches.
Uh-huh. And when she, I'm going to use she, but it could be a he as well, because it's not necessarily it is. What's the bird's reaction to the speaker trying to feed it?
Cautious.
Flies away. It doesn't eat it. How about that as compared to the birds we had in the last one? Okay, anything else that people just want to note right off the bat?
Well, it was a little strange that she goes with the bird flying with water imagery.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I think that's a... Kimberly, yeah.
Yeah.
That's a great point. And I think that in this poem, I'm going to kind of go through this more quickly than I would like, but that there is this definite movement in the middle of the poem where we're kind of dealing with a very specific, here comes the bird, there's the bird, and then all of a sudden we're off in the floating in the sky, and there's oars and the ocean and kind of there's a transition that's made there. So what we're going to try to do as we go through this is to sort of track how that occurs, and I'm going to ask if people what they think of that, and do we buy that that's kind of what happens. But first, I want to ask before we get to that. I talked a little bit about the beginning about how sometimes that poems, the way something is described often tells us more about the speaker than about what we're actually seeing. What do we know about the speaker based on this description? Anything? We're just making guesses here, but.
An observer.
An observer, okay, so somebody who likes to look at things and is patient in doing that, okay?
It's way out there.
Way out there, awesome.
could go in here on nice smooth waters and get that rough spot right in the entrance.
Yeah. Okay. What about by some of the words that are chosen to describe the bird and what's happening and what the birds do? Do any of those words specifically lend to insight?
Words like beads and velvet.
Yes. What do they?
I don't know. I think of more elegant upper class. Mm-hmm. This person's trying to interact with the bird.
Okay. Yes. So there's a difference. The words that are being chosen have kind of a higher level of diction, maybe, than what we necessarily need to talk about the bird that's hopping down the path.
Okay. Convenient grass.
Convenient grass.
We should have stopped yet before this.
We should have stopped. You want? So you're saying you like her? You don't? You're not buying the last one? No. Okay.
In that last one. I think there's all kinds of illusions in there that I don't quite understand. But I think if I figure them out, it would be really interesting.
Okay.
I'll wait.
Yeah.
I don't understand those last two lines at all.
Okay.
Butterflies don't usually swim. Are those two lines connected?
Okay, well,
I have something to say about that.
Okay.
Which is that I was at the aquarium when my child was very young, and there was another little girl who was about 3, and there was this huge tank, one of those great big tanks of fish where it goes like way up high in the ceiling. And this little girl looked up and said, "Look, Mommy, at the pretty birdies." And I don't know exactly what that last stanza means, but I think the distinction between sky and ocean is pretty tenuous. And I think you can look in the ocean and see birds. I think
I'm fascinated by the
still don't swim.
by the sounds in the last stanza.
Okay.
Oars and ocean,
mm-hmm.
silver and sea,
mm-hmm.
butterfly banks,
mm-hmm.
and then all of a sudden, where she could say splashless as they swim, she says plashless as they swim. I mean, it's just fascinating use of words.
And I love that flashless is actually a word.
It is?
I think I looked it up in the dictionary, and it's a small splash. And I
a
wish
flash.
It would have come back, because that's so great!
Yes, but that's my point. Instead of using splashless, she has purposely used flashless.
But how big a splash is a butterfly going to make?
So small.
Just a splash.
Just a splash.
Okay, well, before we decide that she's gone off the deep end for the last stanza of this poem, which maybe she has, we have, and I'm going to, again, I'm going a little bit more quickly here than I would like, but she's watching this bird very carefully and what it does. And for a while, it's pretty straightforward. And then we get to, "He glanced with rapid eyes that hurried all around. They looked like frightened beads, I thought." We're finally into the speaker's head a little bit more. This isn't just going to be an observation from far away. We're now kind of back into that metaphor land of the previous poem. She's going to make a comparison. "They looked like frightened beads, I thought. He stirred his velvet head." Again, like Elsa was talking about, these words are bringing us closer to the mind of the speaker and further away from the bird. And then we get this line that is my favorite line of the poem, "Like one in danger cautious, I offered him a crumb." That line, "like one in danger cautious."
Who's in danger there?
Who, yes, thank you, Gail. Who is that referring to? Is that referring to the speaker of the poem or to the bird?
You can't tell.
You think it refers to the bird? Okay.
"He stirred his velvet head like one in danger
cautious." Right. We have that stanza break there.
Oh, I know.
Right?
It's deliberately ambiguous.
Thank you. So there's a deliberate ambiguity there that could probably go either. You can make an argument for either, for sure.
Or both.
But something happens there where in one line, we're suddenly not sure of who is the bird and who is the speaker anymore. Remember we began, you said, at this great distance, and suddenly we're not sure who's being described. There's some sort of passage, I would argue, going on in that line. And then we get to the offering of the crumb. We know that that's the speaker. And then we get into the moment. more poety sounding language the whole thing. And he unrolled his feathers. What is the unroll? That's a really interesting word to choose there. What does that look like to you? What is? Okay, do it again, John. John, stand up. Do that gesture for us. So sort of a, okay.
Yeah, so it's more ballet-like.
Okay. Anybody else?
Like an angel?
Like an angel, okay. Okay, yeah, so she's accessing sort of different celestial kind of planes or ideas there. So, and now we have, and rode him softer home. We've got home again. Is that what you just said? Home. We've got home coming back in. Though this time it's not capitalized, which is interesting, though before it was. So what home are we referring to here?
It isn't capitalized.
It isn't. Which home?
The ocean.
The ocean, okay. So the bird's returning to the ocean, which is where the bird wants to be, okay? Any other interpretations?
Wherever his home is.
Wherever his home is, okay. John's gesturing again in a way that makes him think that the wings could be oars. Okay, anybody else want to?
Sort of.
Okay, so you buy up to, are people like with the metaphor up to there that the bird could be rowing? Okay. Okay, so he rode him softer home. So this sound of the wings, the softer, could also be what's describing the oars, right? And oars divide the ocean, right? Is that possible? Okay, so we've got the oars dividing the ocean, and we're also seeing what? That's like the oars dividing the ocean.
The wings moving the air.
The wings in the sky, okay, so we've got oars. And so again, we're kind of moving back and forth from what's occurring on Earth to what's occurring in the sky. Two silver for a scene. Anyone want to take a gander at what that's all about? Oh,
on that.
Go, yeah. Of the sky in the ocean, right? So we have a sort of connection there between the sky and the water, the earth. Okay, so we're dealing with the sound of oars dividing the ocean, or butterflies, who are crazy noise makers, right? Off banks of Nu. Anybody want to take a gander at what banks of Nu could be?
Is that an actual place, like the banks of Dover or something?
Wow, that had never occurred to me.
That's what I was.
Wow, does anybody know? I would love to go there. I had. What about this? Anybody want to make another? Any other interpretations?
That sounds like a time reference.
Yeah. Okay.
Banks.
What would the banks be? If the sky is going to be like an ocean, what would the banks? What could the banks in the sky be?
The edges of the ocean.
The edge. So. Right, so for the edges of the ocean we have are the banks, but if we're in the sky, what could banks be?
The rays of the sun.
The rays of the sun, sure. Yes, rays of the sun, or?
Well, if you're thinking of time, I think of like in-between time, because noon is like set time, things happen at noon. You know what you're doing at noon, but then you kind of drift, and you don't really know what you're doing the rest of the day.
That's great, so that's kind of a of a specific time. I also, I think my teacher when I had this dance poem thought that was crazy when I said this too, but every time I see banks of noon, I think of clouds. That those are sort of, that those could be sort of the banks of sky if the bird is cutting through between them, and that I could hear it if you hear that way. But
butterflies may fly best at noon because of lack of moisture.
Oh, that's great. Sure, so just the kind of physical reality of butterflies and their ability to fly. So off these banks of noon, they're leaping. We're still in the sky, but then we get this word flashless as they swim. So we're back where?
Sea.
Kind of rowing. Yeah. So these last maybe six lines here are this constant moving back and forth between the ocean and the sky until we have a sense of them kind of being as one. And where is the bird, and where is the butterfly, and where is the speaker in all of this? So I would argue that that's on purpose, that ambiguity that we end up with in terms of kind of who is where, because the speaker's on the ground, theoretically, and the bird's in the sky, but at the end we have those things joining, just like that line, like one in danger, cautious, I have already crowned. Just as we kind of are unclear about that line and which way it goes, it's that same feeling, I think, in those last six lines of being sure, unsure of which way to look and even who we are anymore for the speaker or the bird. That's my interpretation, so now I'd like people to argue.
But I think he's giving us two choices of how this bird is flying.
Okay.
He's rowing himself softer at home than that whole oar is dividing the ocean and silver for his theme. Or he's rowing himself softer at home than butterflies off banks.
Okay.
Leaping flashless as they swim.
Okay.
So I think she's giving us a choice.
That's great.
About how we want to see that. However that flying is, we got choices now.
Okay. So that
we're like the incredibly brainy.
So that, just like the speaker, we as readers are given a choice to make in the end there of how we're going
to see that flying.
Yeah.
Either a choice or it's like it keeps us suspended.
Mm-hmm.
So that we know things when we're in suspension, we don't know when we focus.
That's wonderful. Suspension is a great word to use, I think, with that ending, that sense of being between and not knowing.
You know, I also would kind of harken back that idea that Dale just says, like a lot of times, you know, Emily Dickinson will start out with something really like sort of different.
Right.
And she starts out, we start out with one drop of water.
Mm-hmm.
Like two drops.
Oh, great.
She's also in suspension on this piece of grass, and yet this drop like explodes into this entire ocean, but we're still on that same.
Yeah, John.
Well, that could be at the end, she's just letting flights and fancy and her words and things like this and this last thing kind of created a magical sense that doesn't have to, that's surreal in a way. It doesn't have to be, it doesn't have to be specific. I mean, what I get from this, again, is, you know, I read these two poems and I just get a sense of someone who's manic depressive. I get a suicidal.
John wants to interview Emily Dickinson.
I get a somebody who's suicidal on the one hand, and then on the other hand, is just thrilled with the wonder of life and the beauty of being and everything full of awe and wonder and excitement and gloriously happy in this poem and horribly depressed and despairing in the other.
So we have two pretty different tones, but also you're saying that in addition to that physical flight at the end, that we maybe have a movement from the specific concrete in front of us into a place of imagination, that there's a flight of the mind.
He just gave us as much of a biography of Emily Dickinson as we probably have.
That's probably true.
I also think that in the beginning of the poem, all the thing that the bird does, a human does, and he's personifying the bird a bit, because the bird's walking down the block, chewing up the angleworm, eating it raw, doing all that stuff that humans can relate to. But by the time he unrolls his wings, he's
doing something that we have no words for, we have no experiential connection, and so he has no choice. The observer almost has no choice but to get kind of crazy metaphoric with it, because I can no longer, she can no longer relate to birdishness.
Yeah.
Because they get to do this thing that's so wild.
Yeah.
That's great. They get to move beyond our form. They get to make movement out of air.
It's kind of the theme I see running through is what happens, what we do when we're not observed, and what happens when we are observed.
Great.
Well, I just think of quantum physics, and that is when you observe something, you change it.
Yes. Great. So the speaker's presence there in some way is altering the reality of what happens. Karen, did you?
It just got me in both of these. Not only are both about birds, and both talk about going home, but they both get offered this prompt.
Okay, so we only have a couple minutes left here, but I am now going to throw out the promised question of which poem is better, or which poem do you like more, or which poem is more successful, however you want to rearrange that question. Or if somebody wants to fiercely debate that both are equal and to ask such an atrocious question of Emily Dickinson that is offensive to all that they hold dear, then that's an okay position too.
I'll pick the first one.
You pick the first one.
It's darker and more difficult in that sense. Sometimes tougher stuff. For me, anyway, it's more interesting.
Let's take a vote.
Yeah.
A vote on which one is better or which one we like better.
Ooh, we'll do two. We're in two votes. The first one, let's do which one you like better. Okay? Who likes the first one better? Okay. Who likes the second one better?
Oh,
no.
I can't say.
Wow, we're tied. Okay. This is great. All right. Which one?
Which one is twice?
This means we can have like wrestling right here too. Okay. Which poem is the better poem? First one. 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay. Second one. Now, some people did vote. Yeah, that was a little bit wimpy.
I just kind of dragged.
You were doing that bird thing at the end of that. I'm in the sky. Okay.
I was just in his class. It was all about Judge Knotts.
Right. That's right. Paul, this is a bad one to follow it up on.
What are you doing?
Does anybody want to make an argument for why they think that one is more successful, or they like the one better? Peter.
Well, besides all those cool metaphysical things people were talking about in number one, there's one other thing that I noticed. And as a former lawyer, everyone uses the word stipulate wrongly. But I presume that she doesn't. And to have a stipulation, there has to be a certain equality between the agreeing parties. And she capitalizes both the parties' names, the shiverers and the farmers, and therefore indicating even more so this metaphysical thing that the shiverers are not mere fondlings or little birds. They are someone, so it's got to be a more metaphorical basis, someone who is, you know, in an equal relationship with the farmer.
And could you take that a step further and talk at all about how that might relate to our Bible study of this morning? When we were also talking about stipulations? Any comparisons?
Yeah, well, it was kind of like I said before.
Thank you. That really is in line with all the people who are in Bible study.
No, well, I didn't want to repeat that, but that was the, you know, Moses was making a covenant with God. But that's kind of hurts my argument a little bit, because obviously Moses and God in that situation don't have this sort of equality.
Although somebody mentioned that, you know, we could potentially meet the farmer as God, in which case we do have
some. Is it equality or like symbios, you know, symbios, or is a need from both?
It could be, that's it.
The farmer doesn't need the herd, but the herd certainly needs the money.
What the father needs for reluctant to come. I mean, and just, and what that does to the relationship.
Yeah. What does that say about the farmer?
And it's plural farmers as well.
Yeah.
For me, part of my judgment is what happens to me. That's where I gave a tie. I love them both. And I've been down the road now through these poems towards anxiety about death, towards beauty that I can't describe, towards us participating in dimensions of life that I had until I read this. So they both get tens on a scale from 1 to 9.
Could I just, I think the farmer does need some goods, and I think God needs humans. I think God needed to create humans, and in many other ways in the Bible indicates that, you know, God is very connected, passionately, a lot of times through Christ with humans. Otherwise, why not just leave it like it was in the paradise?
Well, the weird is not farmer,
this is farmer.
Yeah, also, yeah, we got multiple gods, maybe. You were in.
Oh, good.
Exactly. Well, thank you all for coming. Tomorrow, this is great. And I'm sorry we didn't even get to Emily's Dickinson's great music and sound, which I'm sorry about. But I'm glad to continue the conversation with anybody. And tomorrow will be Elizabeth Bishop, who is also phenomenal. And we'll get into 10:45 in the fireside room, and we're going to do her poem at the Fish Houses, which is awesome. It has a stellar ending, so I'd love to see you all there. Thank you for coming.
What do you mean by that?